I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Last week, President Obama announced his $467 billion American Jobs Act before a joint session of Congress where he outlined his plan to get Americans back to work. Yesterday, the White House put some more meat on the bones of his proposal, calling for changes to the tax code, including limiting deductions and certain subsidies to pay for the bill. Meanwhile, the Congressional Debt Supercommittee is starting its work to tackle federal spending, and some are hoping that tax reform is on the table for discussion. So today in Radio Times, we're going to take a look at the U.S. tax code. How did it get so complicated and unwieldy? What are some of the reform proposals? What are the roadblocks? What are the lessons from previous overhauls? And is fairness possible? And let me introduce our two guests. Eugene Sterley is the Richard B. Fish Chair and Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute. He writes the column TheGovernmentWeDeserve.org. He's the author of a number of books, including Contemporary U.S. Tax Policy. And Eugene Sterley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Delighted to be here.
Also with us is Lori Montgomery, and she covers U.S. economic policy for The Washington Post. She focuses on the federal budget and the efforts to tame the national debt. In fact, joins us from the studios of The Washington Post. And Lori Montgomery, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
And Lori, let me begin with you. And it seems almost unfair to talk about our tax code on the radio. Nonetheless, and I read it's something like 3.8 million words in the tax code. But how would you describe it to our listeners, Lori?
Well, it's unbelievably complicated, and it's growing more complicated by the day. As you mentioned, the jobs program that President Obama rolled out last week includes yet another set of tax breaks that would be calculated in new ways for various families and businesses. And it's become so complicated in part because it's become so difficult to spend money the traditional way in Washington. So on very many occasions, lawmakers instead look to the tax code to accomplish policy goals.
And to you, Eugene Sterley, and we need a short answer for this, but how did it get so complicated?
Well, I think Laurie's exactly right. At one time, we thought of taxes as the way we raised revenues to pay for government. But now we put probably about a quarter of all of our spending programs essentially in the tax code. We use it for all sorts of macroeconomic purposes. That means we try to stimulate the economy or stimulate people to do things. And it's just become a vehicle for all sorts of things.
And when did that start?
I think it started probably 50s, 60s. It was partly when the tax system got very large after World War II. It was gradual but continual. I mean, it's been basically going on for several decades.
I hear a knowing laugh from you, Laura. You want to weigh in on that?
It's hard to say when it started because some of these complications in the tax code just date from the beginning of the tax code practically. I mean, one of the things that is being debated now is whether or not we should have a tax-free treatment of employer-provided health care, and that also dates to World War II.
Well, let me start with you, Lori Montgomery. So we're talking about the tax code. We're talking essentially about the income tax. Who pays income tax in this country?
Well, about 50% of Gene would probably know this better than I because the Urban Institute's Tax Policy Center has done the best research on this, but approximately slightly more than half of all, is it households, Gene, or individuals?
Go ahead,
households.
Gene. Households.
Households. And the number of households that have not been paying income tax has been growing over the years because we've added so many social programs into the tax code that exempts those people who, frankly, are very poor from paying income tax. It doesn't mean they don't pay taxes. Right. They still pay payroll taxes, but they no longer pay or owe federal income taxes.
Eugene, can you flesh that out for us a bit?
Right. Well, there's several groups that don't pay tax. One is the poor. There's another group which is a little complicated, which is those poor who receive something called an earned income credit. Now, we could put this earned income credit, which is basically a job subsidy, we could put it in the spending side of the budget, and then they would pay taxes. But instead, we count it as a negative tax, and then they end up not paying any. So you have the poor, you have the people receiving this job subsidy, you have a number of the elderly who get special exemptions. And then, of course, you do have the people who take advantage of the more, I want to say esoteric, but less available subsidies, such as very special tax breaks for capital, certain types of capital income.
Would you say those are wealthier Americans, the ones that they can use the tax code to their advantage that way?
That's right. But most of them do pay tax, so they really don't comprise a large portion of the non-paying population. It's mainly the people who get a fair amount of subsidies from the system that could be direct spending subsidies, in which case they would pay taxes. It's the elderly. It's the poor. And then, of course, we have an increase in the number of at least temporary poor because we have a number of unemployed people right now in the recession. So the recession is added to the number who haven't paid taxes. But let me make one quick comment here as well. Is Laurie mentioned going back to World War II. Right after World War II, close to half of all households didn't pay income taxes either because the exemption level was high enough. The personal exemption that most families get when you multiply it by enough people kept a lot of people out of paying the tax. And what happened over decades is we had a lot of what was called bracket creep. That is, people moved from a zero rate, if you want to, or from not paying tax into moving into the tax system. So we've been here before when close to half the population did not pay income tax.
Laura, let me just run this sentence by you, and I read this in preparation for today's show. Americans pay less in taxes to the federal government as a percentage of GDP than in any time since 1950. Yes?
That's correct.
And what does that mean? Decode that, if you could, for us.
Well, that sentence refers to the sum of money as a percent of the economy that's being paid to the government in taxes. And right now, that is at a 50-year low. That's primarily because of the recession, but it is also because of the series of tax cuts that were enacted under President George W. Bush. It's because the proliferation of these tax breaks that Jane and I have been talking about. So even though you have slightly more than half of the population paying taxes, the effective tax rate for those people is also not at a historic low, but it's lower than it's been in a couple of decades, if I'm not mistaken.
Jane, you want to add to that?
No, I think that's certainly right. I'll let it go with that.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let me put in a question to you then. So what are the big three deductions when you look at the tax code, Gene Sterling?
I don't have the list right in front of me. The biggest one is the employee exclusion for employer-provided health. That is, most people, when they get health insurance from their employer, it's essentially tax-free. Among the other really big ones are the pension benefits, depending on the years that they're available. So basically, when we have deposits made to our pension plans, they aren't taxed, although they are taxed when we withdraw them. Mm-hmm. Another of the really big ones is the home, all of the tax breaks for homeowners, which are more than just the home mortgage interest deduction. It's also the property tax deduction, special capital gains tax break when you sell your house. Those are very big. What am I leaving out, Laurie?
Well, I happen to have a list right in front of me.
Oh, go right ahead, Laurie, then.
I should have the list in front of me.
I have a partial list here, but go ahead, Laurie.
And according to the Tax Policy Center, the top three over the next 5 years will be the tax-free treatment of employer-provided health care, the home mortgage interest deduction, and lower rates for capital gains and dividends. But right after that comes the exclusion of Medicare benefits. So if you get Medicare, those are not taxed. And the exclusion of pension contributions and earnings. So you can see that these are things that affect not just special interests, but a broad swath of America.
Well, let me talk about, and I'll toss this back to you, Gene Sterling, which is those people that seem to have been able to, as Obama and others have said, use the tax code to their advantage. They use lobbyists in order to get a special break. Is there a breakdown about who those people are?
Well, they're all of us. And in some ways, although we're talking about tax reform, it's not unrelated to the whole issue on budget reform. Currently, the budget of the United States spends or has spending of about $31,000 a household. That is, you take total spending and divide it by number of households, it's about $31,000. And if you then take total taxes and divide it by number of households, it's $19,000. So there's a huge gap between what we spend and what we collect in taxes. And basically, all of us, or most of us, are beneficiaries of one program or the other, whether in the spending system or the tax code. And a lot of the debate over the budget is directly related to the debate over taxes, is, okay, well, who's going to pay to make up this differential? And quite honestly, although I would suggest that the rich do, in fact, get a number of tax breaks, so do the middle class, and so do low-income people. Basically, we're all in this together. And really, if you want to solve these problems, you've got to look beyond the tax system. I'd say it's not just the subsidies and the tax system, it's the subsidies and the direct spending system. We've got to do something to get this to come together. And the hard issue, the really hard issue for the politicians, is it means they've got to ask something for the middle class. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they're very loath to do.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, but Lori, as someone who covers economic policy for the Washington Post, you're down there in Washington. Any way to sort of read the atmosphere in Washington and whether there's any willingness to tackle some of this tough stuff that we've been talking about?
Well, they're talking about it, and you know, there's a lot of noise about tax reform. There has been for most of the past year. But if you talk to the people who would actually be involved in it and who have been involved in it in the past, the aides who would have to score these proposals, you know, it seems very unlikely that there will be any kind of thoroughgoing tax reform before, you know, 2013, before we have a new president. Because the country is divided about what to do about these issues. And we sort of need to have an election to decide, should the rich pay more? Should mm-hmm. we take away some of the benefits at the low end? You know, what's the direction the country wants to go?
And I never know when we hear about someone scoring a proposal and they project, let's say, a decade into the future, Lori, is there a reality check on that? You know what I mean?
Well, it's very hard to go back and tell whether or not budget scores were correct because you don't know what would have happened without the policy. Those scores serve as a series of alternatives. It gives policymakers choices. If you do X, here's what we think it would look like. If right. you do Y, it would look like this. So it's just it's a method to help people make decisions. And the reason it's so complicated in this case is because, as we started this conversation, the tax code is so unbelievably complicated that if you want to change one thing or get rid of one thing here, it's going to affect, you know, seven things over there. And so trying to do any sort of large-scale taming of these tax expenditures, of these tax breaks, would be a fairly major undertaking, not just technically, but as you can imagine, politically. I mean, every one of these things has a constituency.
Well, and we're almost up on a break, but I'm assuming, Lori, especially in the kind of partisan atmosphere in Washington.
Well, exactly. I mean, Republicans don't even, you know, really want to look at these things at all because they consider the spending in the tax code to be tax cuts. And if you take any of them away, then you're raising taxes. So that's a whole nother debate we're having.
Well, we are talking about our tax code today on Radio Times and what, if anything can be done to reform it. That's Lori Montgomery. She covers U.S. economic policy for The Washington Post, focuses on the federal budget and the efforts, as she says, to tame the national debt. Also with us is Eugene Sterley. He's the Richard B. Fisher Chair and Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute, writes a column called thegovernmentwedeserve.org, and we are talking about our tax code, how it works, and what can be done to improve it, make it fairer. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Prostate cancer is second only to skin cancer among U.S. men. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase's Prostate Cancer Risk Assessment Service helps you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of your family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Next time in Studio 360...
This is the built equivalent of a moment of silence.
We visit Ground Zero with the Israeli-American designer of the new National 9/11 Memorial.
This idea of absence, of making visible and present what is no longer here.
9/11, 10 years later, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Laurie Montgomery and Eugene Sterley about our complicated tax system and whether it can be improved, reformed, or changed. And I do want to play a clip from President Obama's speech last week before a joint session of Congress. And here's something that he said about essentially the gap between the wealthy and everyone else.
I'm also well aware that there are many Republicans who don't believe we should raise taxes on those who are most fortunate and can best afford it. But here's what every American knows. While most people in this country struggle to make ends meet, a few of the most affluent citizens and most profitable corporations enjoy tax breaks and loopholes that nobody else gets. Right now, Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary, an outrage he has asked us to fix. We need a tax code where everyone gets a fair shake and where everybody pays their fair share.
Gene Sterley, the president and others have used Warren Buffett to make their argument. Does it hold up?
Well, it's a partial argument. As I said earlier, all of us get a lot of tax breaks out of the tax system. If we don't get tax breaks out of the tax system, we get a lot of breaks within the spending system. And if we're going to get our budget in order, we all have to bear some of that burden. Now, I think the president's right in that the rich are going to have to bear their fair share. And Warren Buffett is right that he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary, where Buffett is wrong is, in fact, that he implies that he's paying a 15% rate. In point of fact, most of the rich have their income in what is called accrued gains, that is, the increase in value of their real estate and stocks, not doing quite as well lately, but at least historically, that's how they made their money. And if they don't even sell those assets, they don't pay any tax at all. So the president's right that the rich are going to have to bear some burden, but that's partly a Democratic argument. It's an argument that's going to be used in the election about the rich paying more. But you can't solve the problem there. As I say, the gap between what we spend and what we raise in taxes is so large that all of us are going to have to bear some burden, whether we're the rich who don't want to pay estate tax, or we're the middle class who think we should have 20, 25 years in retirement, or maybe we're the poor and we think we're entitled to benefits without having to work for them. We're all going to have to do something to get the system in order.
Laura, do you think he'll be able to sell that idea? And yesterday they did go into a little more detail about how they want to pay for this jobs bill, including, you know, limiting deductions and getting rid of certain subsidies. Do you think that will play in Congress at all, especially among Republicans?
I'm pretty confident that I can say it will not play in Congress, because he's been proposing these same tax increases ever since he took office, and even the Democrats have rejected them. Nobody likes that limitation on deductions, not so much because it hits high-income people, but because it hits the real estate industry through the mortgage interest deduction. It hits charities through the charitable deduction. So these things are not popular with anybody. Nobody wants to raise taxes.
Even corporate jets? I mean, I guess there are people that build corporate jets, yes?
Well, the corporate jet thing, you know, I think that Democrats love that one. They love the, special subsidies for the oil and gas industry. But the fact of the matter is, those things are peanuts. I think the corporate jet is something like $3 billion a year. The oil and gas subsidies, according to the Obama administration, is like $40 billion a year, whereas that limitation on itemized deductions for people who make more than $200,000 is something like $300 billion a year. So, you know, I mean, that's the difference we're talking about. I'm sorry, those are 10-year numbers, not a year.
Okay, 10-year numbers. To you, though, Eugene Sterley, why not? Is it even financially possible, fiscally possible, to essentially treat all income the same?
You can go a great deal in that direction. There are times when administratively it's difficult. There are certain things that basically we don't even count or measure, such as, in fact, the fact that our homes, if we own them outright, give us certain benefits. So we don't usually decide to go after that type of income. So some things are hard. International taxation, whatever one's view on it, is very, very difficult. I'll just give you one quick anecdote here. When I coordinated the Treasury tax reform study in the mid-'80s, I was able to go to every staff group and said, look, you can put forward a proposal you think that's going to deal with this issue. And we did try to tax income fairly equally. And I went to the international people, and they hemmed and they hawed, and they debated and debated and debated, and they finally came out with a proposal. It was called per country, but doesn't matter what it was, mm-hmm. which they got out right before we put out the proposal. The proposal came out of the Treasury Department. The whole set of proposals actually took off fairly well. But 2 weeks later, the international people came to me and said, you know, we don't think we quite got that one right either.
Really?
So some of these issues are very hard. I don't mean to imply there's not a lot you can't do. There's a lot of deductions and credits that you could simply get rid of. Some of them, maybe you still favor, like personally, I think there's a reason to favor home ownership, but there are probably a lot simpler ways to do it. And some of them, like education subsidies, you could probably just should probably all be switched to the direct spending side of the budget. So those things you could do if there was a willingness to do it. But let me add one other complication.
Go ahead.
Even if you're just fixing it as opposed to raising revenues, you're just saying this is too complex, you almost always create some losers. There's always some group that's not going to quite do as well when you do the fix. So, like, there's three or four subsidies for children, and one stops at age 17, and one stops when you're when you go through college. You try to combine them. You say, well, gee, if we raise the one from 17 to everybody in college, then it costs a lot of money. But if we pull the other one down to 17, we're going to create a lot of losers. And so you get in this debate about the only system that doesn't create losers is the status quo.
Lori, would we be having this conversation if we didn't have such a high rate of unemployment and underemployment in this country and weren't facing the fallout from the, you know, the mortgage banking crisis of a couple of years ago?
Well, I think we're having this conversation because the meltdown, the economic meltdown and the recession have really jacked our national debt up to terrifying levels to many people. And that's created this, for the first time in a long time, this consensus in Washington that we've got to do something about it, and we've got to start slaughtering the sacred cows. You know, in addition to the tax code, that would be the entitlements like Social Security and Medicare. The problem is, so far, nobody's been able to agree on, you know, are we going to use the knife to slaughter the sacred cows, or are we going to shoot them in the head? We just can't agree on how to do it.
Well, and can you tackle the debt problem, the unemployment problem, and the complicated tax code at the same time, Lori?
Well, okay, so there are a number of different things going on there. I mean, I think Congress at the moment feels compelled to do something to deal with the economy. Many people are very fearful that we're headed towards another recession.
Right.
And but there's also a sense that if we're going to spend some more money to try to create jobs, we probably need to pay for it so that we don't jack up our debt. Because on the other side of the coin, there's concern that the growing debt is actually a drag on the economy because it not only takes away from future economic growth, but it also creates uncertainty among businesses. Are we going to have to pay more in taxes, or are they going to cut spending on things that we, you know, provide? So there's this difficult balance that policymakers are trying to strike, where they are, on the one hand, trying to create jobs, but on the other hand, also trying to get a rein on spending that will, you know, provide more certainty to the economy.
Eugene Sirley, let me go back to you. You were the economic coordinator of the Treasury study that led to the Tax Reform Act of 1986 under the Reagan administration. Are there lessons from that tax reform policy and even process?
I think there are. I mean, you know, the old line that you can't walk in the same stream twice is correct, but there are lessons. And among them is one that I think the president's debt commission, that he ended up not backing all that much, but that was chaired by Senator Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, took to heart. And that is, sometimes when you decide to be big and comprehensive, you don't pay any bigger of a political price than if you decide to be small. And what do I mean by that? Well, in truth, politics is organized so that the politicians, the elected officials, whether Democrats or Republicans, they want to operate on what I tend to call the takeaway side of the budget. I mean, the giveaway side. They want to give us things. They want to give us tax cuts. They want to give us a new tax cut. On the spending side, they want to add new spending items. They come to us and tell us all these things they've done for us. They don't want to operate on what's called the takeaway side. They don't want to talk about tax increases and spending cuts. And one reason is because we tend not to reelect them. when they do that. However, once they have to operate there, once they have to get a system into balance and into order, in point of fact, the protest are almost as loud for doing something small as doing something large. And so there is some advantage to, if you're going to do something, go ahead and try to be a little more comprehensive about it. Go ahead and try to say you've achieved something. If you're going to upset some people because you've had to tell them that, well, some of the spending is not affordable anymore, or some of these tax breaks really shouldn't be around, it doesn't hurt to go ahead and as I say, ask go after a lot. I mean, basically, the ARP and the Chamber of Commerce and the small business groups and the lobbyists for all the special industries, their lobbyists are going to be just as active no matter what you do. So you may as well go big.
Well, interestingly, President Ronald Reagan raised taxes, I'm not sure how many times, but certainly a number of times during his administration. How was he able to, in a sense, Sterling get away with that?
Well, we did have more, at least somewhat more bipartisanship than we actually had some leadership among the Republicans in the Senate who were quite worried about the deficit. These included people like Pete Domenici, who's also chaired recently a commission. He's no longer in the Senate, but chaired a commission that put forward a big budget reform proposal. Howard Baker, a number of other Republican senators were really worried about the deficit. And they combined with a stronger tax writing committee, the Ways and Means Committee under Dan Rostenkowski was more powerful at the time. And these people often decided they really wanted to do something about it. There was also some periods of time when Tip O'Neill, who was Speaker of the House, would get together with Ronald Reagan and they would agree to work together on getting things accomplished. So I think part of it was that we had a bit more bipartisanship than, and there was more of a willingness. Ronald Reagan was not there at first, but there was more of a willingness to accept expansions of the tax base and the removal of a lot of special preferences as good things to do.
And Laurie, that seems like ancient history.
It does seem like ancient history. I mean,
I can barely remember that. Yes, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
The president claims to have a good relationship with the current.
Go ahead, Laura.
The current president claims to have a good relationship with the current House Speaker, but I'm afraid that the current House Speaker doesn't have nearly as much control of his caucus as Tip O'Neill did.
Well, that's interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get callers into our conversation. We are talking about our tax code and the various efforts to try to improve it, reform it, change it, make it fairer, if that's possible. And again, Laurie Montgomery covers U.S. economic policy for The Washington Post. Eugene Sterley is an institute fellow at the Urban Institute, writes a column called The Government We Deserve. He's also the author of a number of books, including Contemporary U.S. Tax Policy. And we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to, looks like George from Havertown to join us on Radio Times. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I love your show.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to make a point because the premium, when they talked about people paying for their premiums, they don't pay, they get this benefit and they don't pay any federal tax on their health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There are two groups that were not allowed to get this benefit, one retired military and the other retired government employees. And I believe this was put through under the tax reform of 86. And we've still been fighting to get this change, and I'm a retired federal employee. So, where's the fairness?
Well, that's interesting, George. Gene Sterley, can you tackle that?
Well, there's all sorts of differentials in the tax system. I mean, the complication comes with this type of line drawing. Speaker was exactly right that that some of these differentials are not fair. But on the other hand, other people will point out differences in benefits, say that retired military, retired government employees get. So I think this argues that you really want to think about things in a more comprehensive way to get at these items. If you start picking every line that's drawn, all of us are going to find a lot of inequities that work against us. But if we're fair about it, we're also going to find a few that are a lot that work in our favor.
Laura, you want to add anything to that?
No.
You don't have to. No, that's okay. I just wanted to check. Let me see what Paul from, looks like Wildwood, has to say. And Paul, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask about the long-term capital gains tax, which was some years ago 25%. I think under George Bush it was reduced to 15%. Mitt Romney is proposing eliminating it. What I want to know is how much impact that tax in general has on the overall revenue of our country and what the impact would be of eliminating it. And it just kind of crossed my mind to ask, most of the revenue comes from payroll tax, I guess, of people making $50,000 or $60,000 a year or less. Is that true or false? And that's my whole question.
Well, those are several good questions. Paul, can I toss to you, Laurie? I guess we should make it clear we've been talking about the income tax, which is different from a payroll tax. Can you expand on Paul's question?
Yeah, I mean, so just on the most basic level, the largest pot of money coming into the government is from the individual income tax. That's about $1.1 trillion this year. Next, I think, is the corporate income tax, which is around $200 to $300 billion, depending on which method you're using to calculate it. And then you've got a sundry, well, what's payroll taxes, Gene?
I don't have the number here, but payroll taxes are bigger than employer. They're I think, about two-thirds, three-quarters of the income tax.
Okay, so maybe a little less than $1 trillion?
$600 billion, maybe?
$600 billion coming in. Okay. So a
and
lot.
And then you've got sundry other. But they don't go into the – I don't really think about the payroll taxes because they go to pay for things. So they don't come into our general budget. You know what I mean? They're paying for the Social Security benefits, and they're paying for the Medicare benefits.
Is that true, Gene?
Yes. I mean, another way of putting this is that wage earners earn about 80% of the income in the economy. And so that's the basic source of most of the taxes we collect. And wage earners pay a Social Security tax. Social Security tax is not assessed on most capital income unless you happen to be a small business. And so capital income is only a moderate, although very important, portion of the tax base, in part because it tends to be earned by higher income people who pay at higher rates. The idea of actually eliminating the capital gains tax actually could not be done without being very, very specific about a particular class of people that qualify, because lawyers have been famous for years at converting what's called ordinary income, that is non-capital gains income, into capital gains income. Anytime we set a differential, we say you're going to get a 15% rate if your income is defined this way, but you're going to pay a 30% tax rate if your income is defined this other way. People have figured out, lawyers in particular, all sorts of ways of making those conversions. And a zero rate would actually really exacerbate that. So my guess is if there would be anything like a zero rate, it would be specified in a way that would be very limited. I was at Treasury many years. The way we always dealt with these proposals to keep the revenue cost under control was to really restrict the number of assets that could actually qualify for such treatment, or else people would convert everything into capital gains.
Indeed. Well, let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about our complicated, convoluted tax code, and Eugene Sterley is our guest. He's the Richard B. Fisher Chair and Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute, writes the column thegovernmentwedeserve.org. Laurie Montgomery covers U.S. economic policy for the Washington Post, focuses on the federal budget and the national debt, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKZ. Quiet Craft Interior, Adaptive HID Headlamps, and Blind Spot Information System are all available on this luxury car. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
On the next Fresh Air, former FBI agent Ali Soufan talks about his experiences interrogating Islamist terrorists. He got Abu Zubaydah to identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11. But then the interrogation was taken over by the CIA and Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded. Soufan's new book is called The Black Banners. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The Norway attacker brought attention to Norway's prison system, which has a much lower recidivism rate, but is it too much like a country club? Also, the Republican debates, is it really a two-man race? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY. Providing integrated urologic care throughout the Philadelphia region, Academic Urology brings together 36 urologists at 16 office locations. More information at academicurology.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen trying to decode our tax code with Eugene Sterley and Lori Montgomery. I do want to play another clip from President Obama's address to the joint session of Congress last week where he talked about corporate taxes. Let's listen.
I'll also offer ideas to reform a corporate tax code that stands as a monument to special interest influence in Washington. By eliminating pages of loopholes and deductions, we can lower one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world. Our tax code should not give an advantage to companies that can afford the best-connected lobbyists. It should give an advantage to companies that invest and create jobs right here in the United States of America.
Lori, again, I was doing a little homework in preparation for today's show, and a journalist was quoted as saying that our tax code as it applies to corporations is both the best and the worst, and that we have this high rate compared to other countries, but then we have all these deductions, which essentially, as we've been talking about in the last 40 minutes, is another aspect of our complicated code. Can you weigh in on that?
Well, that's right. And it's very frustrating to many businesses, particularly those that do not have foreign subsidiaries. Because if you look at who pays the 35% rate, which is the corporate tax rate, it's primarily companies that are the service industries here at home that can't shelter income by transferring it abroad. And, you know, the one of the key problems, Gene touched on this earlier, is that we really haven't been able to decide how to handle that foreign earned income.
Well, and this is quoting from David Leonhardt in the New York Times, Gene Sterley, where he looked at 500 big companies in the S&P stock index. 115 paid a total corporate tax rate of less than 20%. 39 of them paid less than 10%. Is that a little snapshot of our corporate tax system?
Well, certainly the corporate tax has been dwindling in importance for quite a while now relative to what it was. In fact, when the income tax was first put into effect way back in the beginning of the last century, the corporate tax was much bigger than the individual tax. And the tax was actually a class tax. It was a tax on corporations and on richer individuals. And since then, as government has expanded in size and scope, this tax system has moved much more broadly into the middle class. The middle class basically pays for most of government and gets most of government's benefits. The complication in the corporate world, and it is complicated, is the large growth of the multinational companies. And one has to be a little careful here there, so that, for instance, if we're just going to tax corporations because they have a headquarters in the United States, but then most of their operations end up abroad, you know, it's not that hard for the corporation just to say, they'll sign a little piece of paper and say, my headquarters is now in wherever, the Cayman Islands or Ireland or wherever else. And then we no longer have quite the ability to tax them as a U.S. company. So there are a number of complications there. A number of us who have looked at this have often suggested that, yes, there's a case probably for lowering the corporate rate if a company really is doing business abroad, and that's a question a lot of them have been able to gain. But if they're really doing business abroad, maybe there is a case for lowering the corporate rate. But the complicating aspect is that probably means then we should probably raise the rate on the owners of corporations. After all, it's not corporations that we're worried about. It's not the guy who has a General Electric stock in his pension plan that we're worried about. It's the fairly rich owner of the General Electric who we think ought to pay a fair share of tax. And that may mean actually raising the tax on that individual, but we're not willing to do that either. So it's been quite a mess to try to deal with this issue, partly because of the complication, but partly because of the unwillingness to switch from one payer to another. That is, for instance, to pay, switching from the corporation paying as a corporation to switching to actually having the owners of corporation pay more to make up for anything we might do on that side.
You know, Laurie, I have to say I'm getting more and more depressed as our conversation goes on. And by that, I mean, it just seems not just that we have a complicated system, but it seems like there's so many built-in impediments to reform.
Well, there are. And on this regard, it's very frustrating because both parties and the president all agree. If there's one thing they agree on, it's that they want to do revenue-neutral corporate tax reform. And that means they want to lower the rate and they don't want to raise any more money. They want to get rid of the loopholes and just make a lower rate for everybody. But the problem is they can't even agree to do that because so many companies have left the corporate tax system and now pay taxes through the individual code. And so, you know, this, you have this disagreement now between Republicans who want to make sure that all companies are covered by whatever reform happens, which means also doing the individual code. And Democrats are like, nah, we don't, really don't want to go there right now. So there, the impediments are proliferating. They're just very numerous.
Marty, let me add, the impediments to all reform are there, but in some sense we've hit the point of no return in terms of the budget. And so, as I was trying to say earlier, politicians don't want to be on what I call this takeaway side of the budget. They don't want to identify losers. Even in a revenue neutral reform, you've got to identify losers to pay off the winners. But at this point in the budget, the politicians can't avoid it. And a lot of the sort of the stagnation you see, a lot of the large partisanship that we see roaming around, many of these problems relate to the fact that these politicians, and include most of the members of Congress, have never really had to really ask anybody for anything, and they can't get by with it anymore. So at one level, you might say, gee, that's frustrating, it's really hard. At another level, they've got to do it.
And that's the sacrifice word, or I guess the T word, the tax word that we've been talking about.
Yeah, but let me be clear. Okay. It's really not an aggregate sacrifice. I mean, it's like saying we're in a household and we spend more than we earn in income. And now all of a sudden we've got to do something about it. We've either got to spend a little less or work a little harder. In point of fact, that debt that we've been accumulating is a burden. We just haven't identified who's going to pay it or when. And so actually getting the budget in order is in many ways reducing sacrifice. It's just reducing the future sacrifices and deciding we got to do a little more in the current period to avoid all those huge costs out in the future.
Well, let me get some callers back in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Ivan from Phoenixville joining us on Radio Times. Ivan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. It's been great listening to you guys. But you know, I'm a bit naive on the tax breaks and stuff. But you know, I hear in the news about all the record profits for oil companies and other, you know, like banking companies, not banks, but credit card companies and so on.
And
so my naive view wonders if it's not just the subsidies going to the oil companies, but you know, other loopholes and deductions that they claim, so they pay very little tax, as you guys were just mentioning in the the Obama clip that you just played. Outlined. Where do all these oil companies and other companies get taxed and pay their taxes? I mean, do their multi-billion-dollar profits? Instead of raising taxes, can some of that money go back into get paid in taxes?
It's a fair question, Ivan. I'm going to toss that to you, Laurie Montgomery.
Well, Democrats have made a huge issue out of the giant profits of oil and gas companies, and they want to eliminate a deduction that is currently available to all, I think, want to say manufacturers or all corporations, and take that away from oil and gas companies. They have encountered fierce resistance from Republicans who point out that the oil and gas companies are merely taking advantage of the same tax break that is available to others. And there's a resistance in our political system, I think, to picking winners and losers among corporations, just as there's a resistance among individuals, even when you have corporations that are clearly such enormous economic winners.
And what I hear, Gene, in Ivan's call is a frustration and a fear, a sense that the system is rigged against some people and rigged for others.
Well, there's no doubt that the people who have lobbyists do better within both the tax code and the spending system. I think Laurie gave a good example of the differential among businesses, with the number of medium-sized or small businesses, particularly those that are mainly domestic, having to pay higher taxes than other corporations. I guess one just little trivial example of that is a number of the internet companies don't pay. This isn't even the income tax; don't pay sales tax, whereas the mom and pop store and the Main Street stores all do.
Let me see what Ivan. Thanks for the call. Let me see what Tony from Glenside has to say. And Tony, you're in Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering, is there a current estimate on taxes not collected on unreported income, and would a value-added tax be a better solution?
You are referring to the tax gap.
Yeah. Go ahead, Laurie. Seems like you want to tackle that one. Go ahead.
That is a favorite target of policymakers. Uncollected taxes, taxes that are owed that we are not gathering, and the estimate. I believe the only estimate that exists is now about 10 or 15 years old, and it's about $300 billion a year.
Wow.
And this is a giant favorite of many people on Capitol Hill because they don't have to raise anybody's taxes. We're just going to collect the money that we don't get now. And in point of fact, unless you're willing to go to something like a consumption tax, it is incredibly difficult to collect that money without creating invasions into American life by the IRS that we are just very reluctant to accept. I mean, one example is during the recent Health Care Reform Act, there was an effort to raise money by requiring reporting, additional reporting. So if you're a company and you buy something from another corporation, you would for the first time have to report it if it exceeded, I think the number was something like $600. Okay. And they had to repeal it because it was just way too much work. Nobody wanted to deal with it.
I was reading, Gene, that in 2010, the IRS filed 1.1 million tax liens against delinquent taxpayers. Is there a big pot of gold potentially to be put to use?
I would say it's a huge pot of gold. I mean, remember, there's well over 100 million households in the United States, so that's actually not that large a number in the grand scheme of things. And in point of fact, this may surprise people, but the United States taxpayer is actually relatively compliant relative to a lot of other countries. Not paying taxes has a long tradition around the world, and you know, we've had our own whiskey rebellions and other things here because people didn't want to pay tax. I would say, however, there's another part to this story, and that is that one of the great benefits of simplifying the tax system is you basically reduce the non-compliance. You know, if a credit's not available, then you're not going to cheat on it. If you really simplify the number of capital gains provisions, it's easier for IRS to enforce. So, you know, simplification and reform does help you get at this tax gap.
Does it get at the money, though? And I'm thinking about various proposals for a flat tax or a consumption tax, a VAT tax like they have in Europe. Would that bring in the kind of revenue that the government appears to need, Gene Sterling?
Well, it, certainly a value-added tax would bring in a lot of revenues. Whether it reduces noncompliance is a mixed story. If you replace a fair amount of the income tax with a value-added tax, it's generally believed that the value-added tax has certain mechanisms. We're not going to go into it, but certain mechanisms that are easier to enforce. It partly has to do with the fact that if I'm a company and I don't pay tax, sometimes the company that buys for me has to pay my tax in my stead. Mm-hmm. So there are certain mechanisms in there that lead to a bit better enforcement, but let's be clear about it. The evidence across Europe, in fact, most of the world that has value-added taxes, is that it has a fair amount of noncompliance as well. So the value-added tax, yes, could be a major revenue source, but not so much because it's going to reduce noncompliance.
Let me see what Carol from South Philadelphia has to say. Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to put out the question of a point. It seems that when we discuss whether the rich should be taxed more or not, it's always framed just as a which side are you in favor of, the Democrats or the Republicans issue, and that people don't tend to mention that a dollar in the hands of people who need to pay bills and buy things immediately works harder for the economy and much more quickly and primes the pump of the economy and is just of more value to the economy than a dollar in the hands of a very wealthy person who can save it, put it into investments, or, and, you know, there are piles of investment money sitting with nothing to do in the country right now because there aren't good things to invest it in, whereas consumerism is what's needed to drive a recovery. And that's the whole reasoning behind having a progressive tax system in the first place, and that the middle class has been vanishing in this country over decades now. There's been a slide for, you know, toward a greater gap between the rich and the poor, and there's a larger group of super rich people who don't really have to put that money back into a useful form in the economy.
Well, Carol, let me take your point and see what Laurie Montgomery has to say. Laurie?
Well, I think that's true. The problem is there's this vast ideological, I mean, everything the caller said is largely true, particularly at a time when the economy is not functioning at peak performance and you're trying to, you know, prime the pump. You're trying to pump, shovel money into the economy, get things moving again. Virtually every economist who has looked at this, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, Mark Zandi, will tell you that you're much better off getting money into the hands of, say, the unemployed who have expenses, immediate expenses, they'll spend that money, than you are giving tax breaks to the rich. The larger problem when we talk about our tax code outside the realm of economic stimulus and recessions is that there is an ideological divide on this issue. And Democrats would largely agree that one of your primary missions in creating a tax code is fairness, ability to pay, you know, making sure that you're propping up the middle class, that people can reach the middle class. But Republicans have demonstrated in their budget and time again that they value those investment dollars. And they, rather than consumer spending, they believe that what makes the economy go round is the ability of people to invest in entrepreneurship and business. And that's why they talk about lower capital gains rates.
Well, I hate to end on that note only because there's so much more to talk about. And I thank you both for joining us today on Radio Times. Laurie Montgomery, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
And she covers U.S. economic policy for The Washington Post that focuses on the federal budget and the national debt. Gene Sterley, thank you very much as well.
It was a delight, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's the Richard B. Fisher Chair Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute. And you can read his column, thegovernmentwedeserve.org. You can also go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for those phone calls, and thanks for joining us. Yes.